I'm Dean Newland, and welcome to the Business of Intuition, where I coach, facilitate, train, and speak on the hard science and meaningful experience of intuitive leadership in business, so you can make better decisions, forge real connections, and creatively solve problems to amplify your impact and simplify your life. Welcome to the Business of Intuition.
The absence of a barrier allows the natural to flow. Thus, if we are going to tap into our skills and talents, insights and strengths, gifts and purpose, and intuition, we need to remove, or at least to manage, those barriers that get in our way. The idea is if you remove the barrier, then you let love and connection and contribution to flow. Dan Jensen is my next guest on the Business of Intuition, and we had just a wonderful discussion surrounding many of the concepts from his upcoming book, The Power of Pressure, Why Pressure Isn't the Problem, It is a Solution. We talked about many things, including, has the pandemic changed the need for coaching? And he goes on to say that there are two types of pressure. One, a peak moment, and two, ongoing pressure. And the pandemic has certainly surfaced the importance of becoming what he calls pressure ambidextrous. He goes on to say that also pressure is energy to manage, not to avoid, and pressure adds the capacity of energy. Pressure is the ultimate double agent. We also got into this discussion around how do we make pressure an ally and not a foe? That pressure can narrow our attention, but can also create blind spots. And that noticing pressure keeps us in choice, and not noticing pressure, we become dominated by it. As we come back to work, whether it be hybrid or face-to-face, we all should be doubling down on our relationships with people, as well as connecting them to short and long-term progress. Dane is the CEO of Third Factor, an acclaimed speaker. He's also an instructor at Queen's University and the University of North Carolina. Dane oversees Third Factor's delivery of leadership development programs to leading firms across North America. He teaches in the full-time and executive MBAs at Queen's Smith School of Business in Canada and is an affiliate faculty with UNC Executive Development at the Kenan Flagler Business School in Chapel Hill. In addition to his corporate work, Dane works extensively with athletes and coaches, leaders and boards across Canada's Olympic and Paralympic sports system to enhance national competitiveness. He has worked as an advisor to senior executives in 23 countries on 5 continents and is a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review. Dan Jensen. You'll know the, I don't know when she started. This whole thing with Zoom has been interesting in how that technology has changed, but now they're announcing that I guess the meeting is being recorded. So anyway, Dane, thank you so much for being a guest on the Business of Intuition. And you know, we were talking before we got started with the recording here about, you know, how the 4th of July was down in the States. And I know you hail from the great country of Canada. But my question is, and this has been something that's been on my mind lately, is, you know, with all of the incredible pressure and the challenges of the last 18 months with respect to COVID being locked down and all of that, have you seen any different types of needs coming from your clients with respect to coaching? In a sense, has the pandemic changed the desire or the need for coaching? Has it shifted, or is it the same as it was prior to 2020?
Yeah, you know, Dean, it's a great question. And I think there's a couple of tacks that I'll take to it. You know, first, I think one of the things that I really learned as I was pulling the book together is that, you know, pressure is not this kind of one size fits all thing. You know, there are different flavors of pressure. There are different types of pressure. And predominantly, there are really two main flavors that pressure takes. There are peak pressure moments. And these are the things that people often identify of, you know, when you ask people, what's the most pressure you've been under, they often go to a moment, they go to like, you know, if they're younger, maybe a big exam or a job interview, maybe it's a big sales presentation. Certainly when we talk to the athletes that we work with, they often zero in on a particular competition or a race or, you know, gold medal game. So those are the peak pressure moments. But then there's also the long haul of pressure. And the long haul of pressure really is, you know, it's not a moment. It doesn't resolve into a win or a loss. It tends to be this kind of accumulation of, hey, I'm dealing with a bunch of highly important stuff, whether that's financial security or health, you know, and it's highly uncertain. You know, the outcomes are not clear. You know, we don't know how this is going to resolve. And often there is no magical moment of resolution. The pressure just kind of grinds. And eventually you realize that, you know, the load is a little bit lighter. And so, you know, I think, you know, my experience of working with clients over the past 18 months is, whereas in the past, I think people were a little bit more focused from a pressure standpoint on those key moments, like how do I nail this presentation? How do I perform when it matters most? COVID has really surfaced the importance of our ability to manage the long haul of pressure. And it's actually two very different skills, Dean. And that's one of the most interesting things that I've found as I've done, you know, the work to research the book is, I talk about this notion of being pressure ambidextrous. You know, because there are two different types of pressure, often the people who are really good in the peak pressure moments, like the people that you want in your corner in a crisis, they may not be the folks who are really good at the long haul of staying motivated and committed through the long haul, of emerging from these long periods free from regret, feeling that they've acquitted themselves to their potential. You know, because we may not enjoy these periods. I think sometimes people want coaching around like, how do I enjoy this? How do I tackle this head on? How do I make sure I'm not wasting a crisis? And, you know, listen, we can aspire to that and that's great. And there is a big part to navigating the long haul of pressure, which is about, okay, how do we just make sure that we come out of this free from regret? How do we make sure that we acquit ourselves and to build the confidence that says that, hey, I was up to that challenge. I was able to navigate that successfully. And so I think that, you know, that second flavor is where a lot of the requests have come, obviously just, you know, people starting to get worn down and a little bit ground down. And then I think the second thing that we've seen, and this is, you know, very unsurprising, is obviously the transition to remote and now back to hybrid work environments. I think a lot of people were looking for coaching around, okay, this is a new type of pressure. This is a new type of leadership. You know, do I have to throw out everything that I was doing before and build some brand new way of being and leading and performing because now distance is a factor and I don't have that, you know, shoulder to shoulder connection. And so, you know, that's certainly been a big theme that we've seen as well.
So I hear that you've done a lot of interviews with people around this concept of pressure, and hence your book is based on it. But what have been some of the major aha moments that came out of your research around pressure or around the stories you heard? What sort of stuck with you?
Yeah, boy. I mean, you know, just so much stuff. You know, I think the thing that has been most helpful, I think for me personally, and it was an interesting time to write a book on pressure, Dean, was, you know,
I was kind of a third.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Literally, I was about a third into the manuscript, you know, when March of 2020 hit and, you know, everything went haywire. And I had about 6 months of going like, okay, you know, time to figure out if this stuff you're writing actually works. Like, does this work for you? You know, so it's
simulation
really
time. Yeah.
You know, I had to take my own medicine and make sure that it actually did the trick. And so, you know, it was actually a really good period for pressure testing some of the stuff that I was learning. But, you know, I think that the most important thing for me that came out of the book was that there are patterns in pressure. You know, and if we kind of study enough high pressure situations, if we ask enough people about the most pressure they've ever been under, we can start to see the patterns in pressure, and that can help us become much better at using the energy under pressure productively. And that's really what's at the heart of the book. So the subtitle of the book is Why Pressure Isn't the Problem, It's the Solution. And this is something I have come to believe quite deeply after interviewing all of the people that I've interviewed, which is that, you know, yes, pressure can be uncomfortable. And there are downsides to pressure, absolutely, that we can talk about. And when you talk to people about the most pressure they've ever been under, they say without equivocation that it was actually the energy that accompanied the pressure that allowed them to make it through it, that allowed them to perform, that allowed them to, you know, proceed through that pressure. You know, so people talked about having a child for the first time. And it's like, okay, well, what is it that gives you the capacity to be an empathetic version of yourself on no sleep, you know, in the middle of abject terror that you're screwing everything up? It's the energy under the pressure, right? What is it that allows you to nail that big sales presentation? Well, it's the pressure that got you to put in the prep work and, you know, do the homework that you needed to do leading into it. Why are more world records set at the Olympic Games than anywhere else? Because there's pressure, right? It's the energy under pressure that actually gives us what we need to perform in our highest pressure moment.
So is pressure energy then? Is pressure energy?
That's exactly right. Pressure is a form of energy.
Okay.
And, you know, I think inherent in that is it's a double-edged sword. Right. Yeah. Energy is electricity, you know, wonderful, right? It can heat our house. It can, you know, run our stove and our air conditioner. It can also burn your house down, right? If you get hit by a bolt of lightning. And I see pressure the same way. Pressure is the ultimate double agent, right? Because it is energy, energy can be very helpful. And if it's left unchecked, if it's just kind of wildly, you know, sizzling around everywhere, then it can absolutely lead, you know, down the garden path.
All right, so using your analogy of the garden path, I mean, thinking about like Dorothy and the yellow brick road, so you're heading down this path and all of a sudden pressure starts to mount, energy starts to build, you're at a fork in the road, you can go left and it becomes a performance enhancer, if you go right, it becomes something that can take you down. What is that point within the human being's mind that says, I'm going left versus right? How do we determine when that is, and how do we make that pivot so that pressure becomes an ally versus a foe?
So, you know, you've hit at what I think is the core skill that is the foundation for every other skill when it comes to managing pressure, which is, you know, when we are at the fork, and I would even, you know, take that question back a layer, which is, how do we even know that we are at a fork? Are we even aware that we are at a fork? Because one of the things that happens under pressure, and this is hardwired physiologically, is when our bodies get highly activated, our attentional focus gets really narrow. We can absorb less and less information. This is a product of evolutionary biology where, you know, you wanted to marshal your resources to focus directly on, you know, this threat originally that was standing in front of you that you needed to give your full attention. But in the modern world, this creates tons of issues. And actually, you know, the topic of this podcast is intuition. You know, I think one of the challenges of that narrowing of attention is sometimes it robs us of the information that informs our intuition, right? Intuition is this unconscious, you know, continuous process of pattern recognition. And if I'm not accessing all the information in my environment, which is what happens under pressure, it can actually rob me of some of my intuition. You know, one of the examples I always use of this is, let's say you're sitting in a meeting and you've worked really hard to prepare for this significant meeting. You're asking for, you know, budget approval for a big project. You sit down across the table. You've worked really closely with Joanne on this proposal. You know, you've edited it together. You're the one going in and presenting it. You present the proposal and all of a sudden Joanne hits you with a hostile question that you weren't expecting, right? Where does your attention immediately go? It zooms entirely in on Joanne, right? Mm-hmm. You start to, you know, focus entirely on, okay, how do I handle that objection? How do I rebut that? You don't notice that there are four people around the table that are trying to jump in and support your position. Right, you don't realize that you have, because you are so focused in on Joanne that you can't access the intuition that would normally tell you, hey, you know, in this moment, like, let's recruit allies, let's go over to Rob, you know, he seems to want to say something, you know. And so this to me is that moment of the fork, right? When I get that question from Joanne, just to use a simple example, and I do get activated, do I even notice? Do I notice that I'm at a fork in the road, or do I just respond? And so, you know, this is kind of the discipline of when the pressure hits, training my ability in that moment to pause and observe the impact that pressure is having on me. Because until I observe the impact that the pressure is having on me, until I notice, hey, you know what, my heart rate just spiked. I'm starting to think about all the ways that Joanne has just sold me down the river and I'm feeling really anxious and frustrated right now. Until I notice those things, they will dominate me. Right? There is a big difference between being angry and noticing I'm angry. When I am angry, the anger is driving, right? I don't get to choose. When I notice that I'm angry, now I am granted free will. Now I get to choose a response. And so I think one of the things that we see in common in terms of people that are really good at managing, you know, pressure is they have this ability that when the pressure hits, they don't become their racing heart rate. They don't become their anxiety. They step back. And they observe it. They go, okay, my heart rate just sped up, right? And from that position of observation, now I can actually see that there is a fork in the road. And now I have the ability to be a little bit more proactive. I've engaged my free will in making that choice. So, you know, that to me is the precondition. Now we can talk about, it's, you know, probably a fork with about 10 different pathways. There's lots of different choices you can make at that point. But that to me is the precondition, if that makes sense.
Because that's a great, I mean, it's a wonderful title. I mean, I got to say, whomever came up with that, whether that was you or a publicist or something, that's a great title because it's provocative. It seems like, wait a minute, hold the phone. I'm supposed to avoid pressure. What is resilience all about? What is mindfulness all about? What is my meditation tape telling me? Or I'm supposed to be removed of pressure. And all of a sudden you have this twist that says, no, pressure is actually your friend. So I love the way you did that, but I understand it's not just a gimmick. It makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah. So you've mentioned in some of the literature that, you know, you started to allude it. You didn't name it, sort of this inner coach, you know, and I think that that's awareness that you just described. Yep. And now I'm seeing that I am upset versus being the upset person. I can put some distance to that. But then of course we have relationships with others. We are in teams or in organizations. We lead people, others lead us. And so it's always about often that relationship that is not only the source of the pressure, but it's also the solution. It's through other people in a way. And so you mentioned, I think that there's this this concept about being able to name that emotion, but with somebody else. You know, like I'm now going to go public with the fact that I'm now feeling betrayed, you know, for example, you know, maybe I was passed up for a job or what have you. And I might even bring that forth in a team meeting. If that is truly what you're describing here is going public with some of the stuff in public, right? Then how do you do that if there's not psychological safety? If we have a culture that feels that if I now name that pressure that I'm feeling, do I not now risk being seen as weak and all the other negative connotations, which then would just add more pressure?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of threads I can tug on, you know, there. One is about negative emotion, you know, feelings like betrayal and frustration and anger. And I do believe, you know, they're a little bit different than pressure. They're kind of, you know, they can be related to pressure. Certainly, you know, pressure can be accompanied by feelings of fear or feelings of betrayal or, you know, any of those things. But I firmly believe that, you know, negative emotion is something that we have to be comfortable working with as leaders if we are going to help people move through periods of pressure. You know, again, we take the last 16 months, but, you know, I challenge you to find somebody working in an organization who at some point in the last 16 months didn't feel frustrated, didn't feel angry, didn't feel irritated, you know. And again, kind of like pressure, you know, all of these negative emotions tend to be accompanied by energy, right? When I'm frustrated, that's a pretty energized state. When I'm angry, that's a pretty energized state. And so, you know, one of the issues that I see in leadership sometimes is, you know, leaders waste that energy under negative emotion. And they tend to waste it in one of two ways. One is they're so uncomfortable with it that they just retreat. And they go, you know what, you know, Dean's really upset right now. I'm just going to give him 30 minutes to calm down and then he'll come back and we can kind of keep going. Right. Yeah. And so I'm just going to let that energy diffuse and then Dean's going to come back and then we're just going to keep going like nothing happened. And the other way that leaders kind of or waste the energy is they rescue people. And they, you know, they go, you know, Dean, don't be so frustrated. Everybody's going through this right now. It's a tough period. You know, things will get better. Don't worry about it. And in both cases, what I have done as a leader is I have just allowed the negative energy to flow away or the energy to flow away without doing anything with it. And so when we talk about this notion of naming negative emotion, really what I'm talking about here is as a leader, when you see negative emotion on your team, you want to surface it and figure out what we're going to do with it. What are we going to do with the energy under that negative emotion? And so one way to do that is to quite simply start the discussion by naming the emotion and inviting a response. Right. So, hey, Dean, it seems like you're feeling really frustrated right now. And one of the things that's wonderful about this is, you know, some people go, OK, well, I'm not very good at reading people's emotional states. I just, you know, and actually this is one of the things that I'm not particularly good at. I just don't have that kind of, yeah, I guess you would call it intuition, to look at another person and go, oh, they're really angry, or they're really sad, or they're really frustrated. And so this used to be a block for me, right? Well, what if I'm wrong? And here is the wonderful thing, right? The second you label another person's emotional state, you go, Dean, seems like you're really frustrated right now. If you've got it wrong, they will correct you 100% of the time. Like, frustrated, right. I'm furious. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And it's like, phenomenal, right? Now I have the information that I need to coach. I know where you're at.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that ability to, in the midst of pressure, when people are going through adversity as leaders, we have to be comfortable surfacing the energy under negative emotion and then working productively with it, you know, doing things that allow people to get to a good answer to the question, what are you going to do with that energy, right? Where are you going to park the energy under that frustration? Because there's a lot of things you can channel that to. Let's talk together about how we can channel it productively, right? To action, to the things we can control, to the things that we can influence, and away from the unproductive stuff. Now, I would say, you mentioned doing it publicly. Mm-hmm. You know, I think self-disclosing emotion as a leader publicly is a wonderful way to build psychological safety. So to be the first one to say, hey, you know, I don't know about all of you, but I've been feeling really frustrated these past couple of weeks. And I want to just check in and see how everybody else is doing. Like, I think that self-disclosure is a great way to begin to build trust and psychological safety in a team environment. I would agree with you that I think it's a pretty high-risk move to, in a public environment, go, hey, Dean, you seem pretty frustrated right now. What's up? Like, you know, so I think unless you've got, you know, a pretty good foundation from a relationship standpoint, I think that's a tough place to start.
I want to go back to something you said about the emotion and being able to sort of ride that wave, ride the wave of that energy. And I think there's been a common understanding or a perception or a mindset that when there is conflict between two people, call it a friend and a friend, a husband and wife, a team member, a leader, mm-hmm. that, well, once the energy starts to rise, it's probably good to take a step back and go to your separate corners, come back when you've got a clear head.
Yep. You
know, we've heard that for a long, long time. You know, parents do that to kids, we do that to our employees. And so I'm wondering, is that the right thing to do? Because we've lost the emotion, to your point, it's dissipated. It's now neutralized in some ways. Mm-hmm. And are we missing an opportunity? At the same time, the emotions that are pretty high, we have experience, at least a lot of us do, that's when we get into trouble. That's when we send the bad email. That's when we say things we wish we hadn't said. That's when relationships become really damaged. When we have gotten into that reptilian part of our brain that isn't thinking, you know, about the big picture. So what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think absolutely there is a point at which, and this really just goes back to that hardwired relationship I mentioned earlier between how activated we are internally and how much information we can absorb. So, you know, if my activation level starts to get away from me, you know, if I get triggered and all of a sudden my, you know, my physiology spikes, you know, there becomes a point at which I actually literally can't hear what the other person is saying. You know, I don't have enough attention to actually absorb the information because I am so fired up internally that I have retreated to, you know, only picking out the words that support my position. I just don't have the capacity to actually hold two opposing points of view and objectively kind of go, okay, where's the common ground here? How can we build on each other? And so, you know, I do think 100% there are moments in which you do need to put some time and space in and just let things come down a little bit if the goal is to be really collaborative. And what I would say is, I don't want to call it a better version of that because it's not. Sometimes you do just, but another path in those situations is to do what we just talked about, which is instead of when you feel the temperature rising, instead of going, you know what, we just can't handle this. We can't talk when we're like this. Let's get some space. This is when you move to that place of awareness and go, hey, you know, I'm feeling really, you know, angry right now. I notice my heart's racing. You know, my thought patterns are all about how can this person be such an idiot, right? When I notice that, you know, now I am at a fork in the road because now I can choose the path of advocacy of just like, I'm going to keep hammering my agenda forward in this conversation. Or I can go, you know what, if this person is as passionate as they are about their point of view, what if they're right? Mm. And let me proceed from the belief that they might be right and start to inquire as opposed to advocate. You know, again, it's, hey, Dean, you know, you seem really committed to this point of view, right? What am I missing that you're seeing? You know, Dean, it sounds like you're getting really frustrated with me right now, right? What is it in particular that you're finding most frustrating about the conversation, right? Mm. Like, there is that moment of choice where we get to the fork in the road where we can either choose to, you know, drop our agenda and understand the other person better, or continue to try to ram through, you know, whatever it is that we're trying to ram through. So I would say you kind of have two options, right? You can either give it some time and space and let things calm down a little bit, which may or may not work, right? You might come back together and still be just as entrenched in your points of view, but at least maybe it's a little bit less emotional. Or you start to cultivate the skills that allow you to step back and notice and actually move to a place of curiosity when you were in the middle of those conversations, to essentially be the bigger person and tap into whatever that other person is getting really passionate about to try to understand it. And I think sometimes people feel like, okay, but am I not seeding, you know, am I not seeding the high ground here? If I start to get curious, am I sort of like admitting that they're right or they have a point or like,
yeah.
And that's not the case, right? You don't have to necessarily agree with it, but until you get that other person to a place where they feel like they've been heard, that you've actually understood what they're bringing to the conversation, it's very unlikely that they're actually going to be open to influence or get into a place where they can really hear you.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I'm thinking about some of the coaching conversations, and even in my own personal life, there's such a almost like a division between this is what's acceptable in most cultures. If we're data-based, we're thinking about rational sort of prefrontal cortex conversations. Mm-hmm. It's action-oriented, we're moving forward, it's strategic. And then there's this other place where we become the doctor, you know, the Jekyll and Hyde, where we're hooked. The emotions yep. are high, and it's almost like there's a sense of embarrassment. And I know I am not myself right now. That's almost how right. I feel, right? I'm an yep. imposter. Like, what the fill in the blank is going on with my emotions?
Yep.
And to share that, which I know is not who I am, almost seems like I should just let that go and swallow it and move on and pretend everything is fine. Or sometimes it might, you know, burst and I create more of an issue. So I think you're right on about some of the stuff you're talking about. Is it your understanding that people over time build tolerance to pressure? Meaning, like, if you were an athlete, I know I could go 1 mile and that's about as far as I could go. And then the next 3 weeks, I can go 3 miles. Is that the way pressure is? Can people build up pressure tolerance?
Yes. Yeah. So I think the research on this is pretty clear. And for us, I guess, you know, and when I say us, I mean, you know, my team here at Third Factor, I think our R&D lab for some of this stuff is kind of the world of elite sport. You know, we've been involved with the Olympic and Paralympic movement for a long time now, and have had the pleasure of working with over 100 athletes that have medaled at the games. And, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, Canada, where I'm based, one of the things we've learned as a country is you can actually really improve performance in international competition by focusing diligently on the mental side of performance. It is a trainable skill. It's something that can be improved and it can be developed over time. And you know, the easiest way to illustrate that is with data. You know, there's a program in Canada called Own the Podium. And Own the Podium was established when Vancouver won the bid for the Olympic Games, which they ended up hosting in 2010. And, you know, prior to Vancouver, Canada as a country had the dubious distinction of being the only country that had ever hosted an Olympic Games and not won a gold medal on home soil. And in fact, we were so good at this, we did it twice. We did it, nobody had ever done it. We did it in Montreal, we did it again in Calgary.
That's awesome.
On the Podium was created to say, okay, this is not happening a third time, right? We are not doing this again.
Yeah.
and so their sole focus was on medal production, right? How do we produce the most possible number of medals at the Vancouver Games in 2010 and ongoing? They're still around. They're a great organization. But one of the things they looked at in the early days was something called the conversion rate. And the conversion rate basically says, okay, if you as an athlete or a team, if you finish top five in the world the year before a Games, like at the World Championships or World Cup, what percentage of those athletes convert that top five performance into a medal at the Games, into a top three the next year? And when they did their original research, Canada was sitting at about 26%. Just for context, Germany was converting in the 90s. The United States converted at 104% in Salt Lake City. So this is like a huge delta, right? Huge gap.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you look at the data, it's like, okay, if you can compete with and win against the best in the world the year before in Olympic Games, and you can't do it at the Olympic Games, right? The solution is not to hit the gym harder, right? This is not like a physical issue. This is not a strategy. The issue is, can you do it when it matters most? And so this core finding really drove kind of a renaissance in Canadian sport of investment in mental performance. We started partnering athletes much earlier with full-time, what are known as MPCs, mental performance coaches. And it has had a profound impact. You know, our conversion rate is in the high 70s, verging on 80, you know, we've more than tripled it in the span of a decade. And so, you know, I look at that experience and I go, absolutely, right? When we're thinking about pressure, when we're thinking about performance, we need to be investing the same kind of discipline and rigor on the mental side of performance as we do on the tactical or technical side of the performance, you know, whatever that is for us.
Now it all makes sense. You know, you just, that last sentence is like, I was going to ask you like, well, why did you write the book in the first place? And how does this tie into, you know, sports? And all of a sudden, like, whoop, it all just fit in. I get it. The mental performance coaching makes a lot of sense because I've had this, you know, I've been coaching for 28 years or so, and there was always this, well, yeah, our business coaching is not the same as sports coaching. We use the same term, but they're very different approaches. One could say that we're going to help a person find their answer. Another is going to be that we're going to help them through our background, our history, mentor them towards their own performance. So there's a different sort of relationship to knowledge. And yet what you just said made a lot of sense. You know, this mental performance coaching can be applicable whether you're working with a team or whether you're trying to, you know, win in a gold medal in the Olympics. That's perfect.
Well, you know, and I think, Dean, listen, you're absolutely right. You know, our lives are not like the lives of Olympic athletes. Our roles as leaders are not like Olympic coaches. I think one of my pet peeves, to be totally frank, are people that come directly out of the world of sport and go like, hey, you know, middle manager at a giant bank, like you should do what this Olympic skier did, you know, and it doesn't work, right? It's just such a different context and environment. And at the same time, pressure is one of those things that is a fundamentally human experience, right? There are just fundamentally human things that happen. Your heart rate increases, your attention narrows, your muscles tense up, your pupils dilate. And so, you know, I think the stuff that I'm really in search of, and that as a firm, we're really in search of, our founder, Peter, always talked about them as the laws of physics, right? It's like gravity looks very different on Mars than it does on Earth. It's still gravity, right? It's still the same fundamental force. And so I think when it comes to pressure, there are just some universal sort of laws that are going to look a little bit different if you apply them at the Olympics, but actually fundamentally are the same. And that's really what I'm trying to find. And that's why, you know, the whole idea of the book was, let's interview everybody, right? Let's interview, yes, athletes, but let's talk to busy parents. Let's talk to overworked managers. Let's talk to people in the military. Let's talk to people in politics. Let's talk to emergency, you know, surgeons. And, you know, and what starts to get revealed when you talk to such a broad cross-section of the population is, you know, there are kind of three things that we need to understand if we're going to understand pressure. We need to understand importance. You know, how we as human beings have coded the outcome of this event, how important we are seeing it as, is a direct toggle on pressure, right? How much pressure I'm going to feel. The second is uncertainty, because just because something's really important, you know, it won't really create pressure unless it's also uncertain. And the third thing we need to understand is volume, right? And this is what I kind of get into in the book, is the pressure equation, that is, pressure is a function of importance multiplied by uncertainty multiplied by volume. And I think if you can figure out how to relate to those three things, to see what you do is important while not getting overwhelmed by how important it is, to manage uncertainty while embracing that there is uncertainty that cannot be tamed, and to create space for volume while at the same time being ruthless about simplifying the volume that you choose to take on. You know, if you can kind of do those three things really well, it kind of doesn't matter if you're an athlete or in the military, or, you know, you're going to develop a pretty productive relationship to pressure.
And when you say volume though, Dan, you're talking about the amount of, is that?
Exactly. So, you know, the first two parts of the, you know, pressure only needs really two things. It needs importance and uncertainty, right? I need to go, hey, this matters to me and I don't know how it's going to turn out. That's where we experience pressure.
Right.
Volume is really the multiplier. It's like, okay, so how much is on my pile right now? How many important, uncertain things am I being asked to juggle simultaneously?
Got it. So this morning I was at the gym and I was working out a little bit and there was some sort of tennis match on.
Yeah.
And I was watching sort of as I was doing reps or whatever, I could almost determine whether or not the person throwing the ball up to serve was going to make it over the net or not. There was a certain sort of, I don't know what it is. You probably see this all the time. And that's why I love watching the Olympics, is that I'm not only interested in what's going on with the physical manifestation of what's happening mentally, and you can almost see it happening. And I remember once when I was a kid, my father and I did a lot of tennis together, and he turned me on to a book called The Inner Game of Tennis.
Yeah, Timothy Galloway.
Fantastic.
Great book.
Really great book. And it became sort of like a philosophic Bible for me around sports, because I always learned so much about myself mentally by how I was feeling and how then it got manifested in how I skied, how I ran, how I did whatever. And I think that that's something that we could use also in business, is like, what's showing up for me as I walk into this meeting? What's my mental state as I get into this conversation? And how is that, what is that reflecting back on me? You know, that whole mirrored effect. But, you know, the last question I want to ask you, because I could talk to you, buddy, all day. You know? this has been fascinating. But all right, so I'm a team leader. We are now bringing everybody back. You know, you said up in Canada, it's not quite the way it is here in the United States, but nonetheless, we are now in a new environment. We have a lot of organizations are going into sort of a hybrid effect where we've got live people who are in the room with us and people who are Zooming in or WebExing in, and there's a combination of both. And so I listened to you, I read your book, I get it. I want to be able to, you know, maximize my ability to encourage people to, you know, work with pressure in a positive way. And I'm going to put something on my agenda that's going to reference this.
Yep.
What would that be from what you, I mean, even little tidbit, how could we introduce this into, say, my first meeting back with my team?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think, you know, let me start by saying people sometimes think that it's only negative stuff that creates pressure. You know, all change requires adaptive energy. Anybody who's put a reno on their house or had a kid, these are very positive things. They create pressure for people. And so I think, you know, amidst all of the excitement about return to office and back to normal, you know, we can't lose sight as leaders of the fact that this is going to create pressure for people one way or another. And so I think, you know, embedded in your question is, let's just acknowledge that and recognize that we want to be thinking about it from a leadership standpoint. And not going like, what is everybody complaining about? Like, we're back to normal. This is wonderful. You have more flexibility than you've ever had. Like, can we all stop whining, right? There's going to be pressure. And then so from a tactical standpoint, you know, a couple of things that I'd highlight. First, and you really spoke about this, Dean, earlier, is one of the things that really mediates pressure is the relationship that I have, in particular with my leader. You know, Gallup's research on engagement would tell you that, you know, the relationship somebody has with their immediate supervisor is the number one predictor, both of engagement, but also of burnout. And so I think, you know, leaders in a hybrid world are going to have to be much more diligent about building the kind of relationships with their people that are going to allow them to have open and honest conversations and have that discussion around where am I really at under this pressure? And that we don't fall into the proximity bias of kind of naturally building relationships with the people who are still in the office and management by, you know, exception, where we just kind of parachute in every once in a while to correct a mistake for the people that are, you know, that are remote. And so one of the great coaches that I have the good fortune to know and chat with from time to time is Roy Rana, who coaches with the Sacramento Kings in the NBA. And he has this great phrase, which is 30 seconds for every player every day. And that to me is a real bellwether in the hybrid world. It's like, okay, am I getting my 30 seconds with every player every day, whether they're in person or the remote? Am I doing the work that I need to do in order to, you know, build that foundation of having a relationship? And so I think that's one that I would really keep front and center for folks, is the discipline around building relationships. The second thing is, you know, I think one of the single biggest toggle on pressure is control. You know, do I feel like I have a sense of control or influence in the situation, or do I feel like things are out of my control and I therefore start to feel a sense of helplessness? And, you know, helplessness is really at the root of the negative impact of pressure. When I feel like there's nothing I can do, I can't influence it. And so I think as managers and leaders, we want to feed the sense of control that people have coming back. And one of the best ways to do that is to connect people with progress. And often in organizations, right, we define progress in very sort of hard, you know, this is what goes on the scorecard. These are the KPIs. They tend to be lagging indicators. It's like, okay, is revenue going up? Is profit going up? Is headcount going up? You know, I think when we're going through these periods of change, we have to be really deliberate of sitting down with each person on our team and going like, okay, what kind of progress are you going to make over the next month? And that may be progress simply in terms of, I'm going to get really comfortable with my routine of, you know, 3 days remote, 2 days in the office, and I'm going to be able to be productive wherever and however I'm, you know, I'm showing up. Okay, great. Let's make sure that we have a chance for each person on the team to feel like they're making a sense of progress. Because when people feel like they're progressing, engagement goes up. When people feel like they're stuck or moving backwards, that's when pressure starts to feel corrosive. And so I think having some of those conversations can be really helpful.
Excellent. I love it. 30 seconds everybody every day. I think that's a great tip. Also, connecting people to progress, also a great idea. Dana, again, fantastic stuff here. I really, I'm impressed by your work and your intellect and your research. I'm looking forward to reading the book. How can people connect to you if they so desire?
Yeah, so you can find me, my website is danejensen.com, which has information on the book and everything else. I'm also on LinkedIn at Dane Jensen and Twitter at Dane Jensen. And love to, any questions or comments, would love to hear from you.
Excellent. We can continue with the great work.
Thank you so much, Dean. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Intuition. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Dean or Mission Facilitators Leadership, go to mfileadership.com. That's mfileadership.com.